Hey, this is Peter Biello, host of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Programs like this one are really important. They help us reflect on the week's news, which moves so quickly these days. And support from people like you help keep it going. So if you use this podcast, please consider making a contribution that works for your budget. $10, $20, whatever works for you. We just ask that you give now at nhpr.org or follow the link for the show notes. And thank you very much for supporting NHPR. All right, here's the show. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Governor Chris Sununu's top drug policy advisor resigns after accusations of inappropriate workplace behavior. Checkpoints on Interstate 93 net 17 arrests, and the New Hampshire ACLU raises an eyebrow. And as the state Supreme Court weighs the constitutionality of a bill that would merge the definitions of domicile and residency for voting purposes, some say the bill is not ready for judicial review yet. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them this hour. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word there. And we are streaming a live video of this radio show, so it is very easy to listen and watch. Check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are NHPR's Casey McDermott, Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org, and Dave Solomon of The Union Leader. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Again, the phone number for you to join the conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Of course, you can email exchange at nhpr.org. Because the news was moving so quickly with respect to the voting bill and the question of judicial review yesterday, we're going to bring in, for this part of the show, a couple of voices on this. One of them is Gilles Bissonnette. He's legal director with the ACLU of New Hampshire. His organization, along with the Fair Election Center, filed a brief arguing that House Bill 1264 is unconstitutional. Again, this is the bill that would merge the definitions of domicile and residency for voting purposes. It would have consequences for many college students in the state who are domiciled here but not necessarily taking up residency here. Gilles Bissonnette, thank you very much for joining The Exchange.
Thanks, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. So, Gilles, why do you think this bill, HB 1264, is unconstitutional?
Well, a few reasons. As our brief explains, the effect and intent of this bill, HB 1264, is to impose motor vehicle fees on voters who live in New Hampshire but who know that they'll be leaving the state at some unknown point in the future. And I think anyone who has gone to the DMV in New Hampshire knows that these fees are quite significant. $50 for a driver's license and registration fees can cost hundreds of dollars. And I think it's clear from the bill's legislative history that this bill is really specifically targeted through these fees at deterring college students who are constitutionally entitled to vote in New Hampshire from exercising their right to vote here. And so for those reasons, we're asking the court to deem this unconstitutional if it decides to take on the questions presented by the governor and executive council.
And you're questioning whether or not the judicial review should even happen. Well, why is that?
Well, and this is because back in 2015, the House of Representatives similarly sent to the Supreme Court a request for an advisory opinion on a very similar voting restriction that would, like 1264, impose a post-election poll tax on certain voters, particularly college students. And what the court there held 3 years ago is we can't really decide the constitutionality of voting questions like this without the benefit of a full factual record developed through adversarial litigation. And so in cases like this, the normal course is for lawsuits to be brought by parties, for there to be depositions and what lawyers call discovery, where the burdens of the law are vetted through that process, and where the state has to prove that what they're accomplishing is tailored to whatever governmental interests exist to justify the law. And none of that's really happened here. These questions are being sent to the court in a vacuum without any type of record, and we, for those reasons, we think the court really can't ultimately decide this question. But if it does, we think, based on the evidence that we present in our brief, that the bill, must be declared unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying essentially is that the bill would have to become law and someone would have to challenge it in order for the court to accurately determine whether or not it's constitutional.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in that particular case, the plaintiffs or the petitioners would put on evidence showing the burdens, and based on those burdens, the court would determine the level of scrutiny that that is applied. And that really can't happen without a full record. And that's exactly what the court concluded in 2015. And really, the situation here is no different.
Okay. One of the arguments made in favor of HB 1264 is that, other states have similar provisions in their laws, that states get to decide what it means to be a resident for voting purposes. Is there something about New Hampshire's constitution that makes that kind of situation not so great here?
Well, our constitution doesn't use the term resident. It uses the term domicile. And so domicile in New Hampshire is the criteria to vote. Now, I would note that the definition of domicile that's used in determining the criteria to vote is really no different than the criteria used in most states to vote. They just don't necessarily use the term domicile, right? The term that they may use is resident or some other term. But the definitions are really not all that different nationwide. And it is not true that most states tie voting to motor vehicle registration fees. In fact, most states don't do that. Maine doesn't do that. Vermont doesn't do it. Not only does Vermont not do it, in Vermont, college students and individuals who are in the state for a fixed duration don't have to comply with motor vehicle fees, which is exactly the current situation in New Hampshire. So, in fact, I think tying motor vehicle fees to voting, as this bill would do, would make New Hampshire not only an exception nationally, it would create severe constitutional problems, because the imposition of fees on voters simply because they decide to vote in New Hampshire is the very definition of a poll tax.
Union leaders Dave Solomon has a question for you, Gilles.
Just a question. In their brief yesterday, the lawyers for the Secretary of State make the point that there'll be no change in enforcement, a coordination of enforcement of election laws with the Department of Motor Vehicles. So how would the activity of voting on the ground actually change the day after this is passed, if, much like Maine, New Hampshire has no plans to cross-enforce motor vehicle and election law?
Yeah, well, a couple points. I mean, first, I was surprised by the Secretary of State's brief. I mean, the Secretary of State's brief basically says this has nothing to do with voting at all. I think it's important to note that the Secretary of State was the chief proponent of this bill and went to the legislature and testified in support of it before the House and Senate. This has everything to do with voting and elections. This bill came out of the Senate Election Law Committee and the House Election Law Committee. The Department of Motor Vehicles has not been came out and been an active proponent of this bill. I think what's likely to happen if this passes. Setting aside criminal enforcement, and I would note that if folks don't pay these fees, they actually would be committing a crime, is that college students are going to be intimidated into not voting, because they are going to be told, folks are going to go to college campuses and say, if you vote, you have to pay these fees within 60 days, and if you don't, you'll be committing a crime. And I think it's clear that that will have a deterrent effect on these individuals who have a constitutional right to vote here.
Gilles Bissonnette, legal director for the ACLU of New Hampshire, talking about a brief you filed to support the claim that HB 1264 is unconstitutional. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
And we want to get another view on this topic, and that's from Ray Chadwick, chairman of Granite State Taxpayers. He sees HB 1264 another way. Ray Chadwick, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, Peter, pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of Gilles Bissonnette's argument that under HB 1264, college students might be intimidated into not voting?
I think the question that I suppose is subject to basically how much they understand the laws, and people will advocate to help them with that. There are already a variety of sources assisting college students and others in their efforts to vote. the point we would raise is that nobody gets denied the right to vote here. The question is whether the state has the right to provide an expectation that those that vote here are actually resident. And I point out that prior to court decisions, the statutes actually made residents, domicile, and inhabitant equivalent. It's been a court decision that took issue with the words for the indefinite future and therefore created a different perception, and this bill rectifies that. So the reason we are involved in it, we think the current situation provides two classes of citizens. And I won't just deal with college students, pretty much anybody, where one person is a resident, they are expected to comply with motor vehicle laws and various other things. Another person is a non-resident, is not expected to comply with the obligations of the state, but both of them can vote. I point out, Peter, that in 2016, the Secretary of State issued a report. In fact, NPR obtained it through a 91A request. And that showed that 6,540 people registered to vote and voted in 2016 in state without a state driver's licenses. Interesting in the data, though, is that of that group, 491 people used an out-of-state driver's license to change their registration from one town to another in New Hampshire. So these were people already voting in New Hampshire who changed to another town and used their out-of-state driver's license, which in most states means proving identity in the other state, residence in the other state as well. They used it to vote here, using a document that proves the residence in other states. And what we think that does is provides for two separate classes of people who can vote here but aren't subject to the same obligations of the state. We think that's problematic and basically an affront to the idea of equal treatment under the law.
NHPR's Casey McDermott has a question for you.
I did want to point out that, as Ray noted, we did obtain that data, and that it is an out-of-state ID is a valid form of proving identification in New Hampshire. I do think it's important to note that per data that was released from the AG's office earlier this week, that from the 2016 elections, they've been able to go through all of the verifications that people have provided in order to prove their domicile in New Hampshire. And that all but a handful of cases, they have been able to verify that people did actually provide other kind of supplemental documentation to say that they had some kind of ties to New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. So, Ray Chadwick, why should voting be tied at all to having to have an interaction with the Department of Motor Vehicles? That would, as you say, make everybody equal, but it's also whether you drive or not has nothing to do with voting.
No, my point is that an out-of-state driver's license shows you are a resident of another state. I don't think that voting is, there's no attempt here to tie voting to having the driver's license. The attempt here is to say voting is a privilege of a resident. And the Supreme Court in 72 really made that comment, and it said that states have a right to determine that a voter is a bona fide resident of the relevant political jurisdiction. So the issue here is establishing voting as a right of residence, and voting in the state as a right of residence in the state. If you declare yourself a resident, then there are consequent obligations that come along, like getting a driver's license, paying taxes, whatever goes with that. The issue here is who should be able to vote, and we believe it should be people who meet the requirements of residency or domicile, however that is defined, but we don't see that distinction. We should point out that people that are in state, for example, let's pick college students, various other states make it very plain that college students can indeed vote in their states if they declare residency. In our brief, we point out that Maryland even tells students that if you want to be a resident here, you can declare residency. However, be sure you make sure that you are willing to give up your residency in your home state. So I don't think any of this is remarkable. compared to practice in many other states, which has all been held to be constitutional.
Ray Chadwick, Chairman of Granite State Taxpayers, thank you very much for calling in and sharing your views on this.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. We'll spend a little more time talking about HB 1264. If you have a question or comment about it, give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We've got Gary Reno here. We haven't heard from you yet, Gary, from indepthnh.org. What do you make of the arguments you've heard so far?
Well, what I think, step back a little bit, I think this is all about demographics, really. We're talking about a Republican Party that's losing its numbers. I mean, we have an increasingly diverse country, and immigrants and minorities aren't particularly lining up with the Republican Party. At the same time, younger people are basically breaking 60 to 40 to the Democratic Party. The only way that Republicans can stay in power is to do things like this, to sort of limit who people who might be more inclined to vote Democratic is the best way they can, and then they can provide themselves with a little bit more time to hold their majority.
Casey?
I do think that it's important to note that both parties in New Hampshire will acknowledge that in tight elections, the college towns really make a difference for the Democrats in particular. That if they're, you know, on the line generally across the state, that the returns in Hanover, the returns in Durham around all of those college areas can really push them over the line if they really do a solid get out the vote effort there. So it would make sense that the arguments in this case are breaking down the way that they do along party lines, where you see Democrats rushing to tie this to, you know, efforts to disenfranchise college students and really trying to drum up college students around fighting back on this kind of legislation. And on the other side, where you hear arguments that this is, you know, merely an attempt to make sure that fair is fair and that if a college student is not truly tied to New Hampshire, then he or she should not participate in our elections here. But I think just to kind of leapfrog off of Gary's point a little bit too, looking at the recent history and the electoral outcomes in New Hampshire, I think that one only needs to kind of pull up the data from the college towns to see what an influence they do have.
Mm-hmm. Dave, any comment?
Their influence has been, exists, no question. The college town vote counts very largely in the Democratic column. But the electoral districts have been drawn in such a way, particularly the Senate and Executive Council districts after the census of 2010. The Republicans held the State House and had the privilege of redrawing the districts. And they've actually been drawn in ways that significantly can dilute the influence of those college towns by compressing their influence into a relatively small number of districts that could be affected by their presence. So that's had an effect on diminishing the vote. I think what's interesting as this debate has unfolded is that the opponents have articulated a very consistent and a very accessible argument: this suppresses college voting. And it seems to resonate with people inclined to believe that. Now, the support, the rationale for the legislation has changed. There have been some consistent arguments that it's very simple. We believe you need to be a resident of the state, not someone who's just visiting to vote here. Or there's voter fraud, and this will be a way to address it. Or there's two classes of citizens, each with different obligations. That seems to be a fairly abstract argument for a lot of people. And the one that voter fraud is rampant is largely dismissed, and so it's come to a matter of perception. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think there's a problem, so we need to take steps to correct it.
The question of who is at stake, still an open question. Who has a stake in the state and can vote here? We'll talk more about voter fraud, allegations of voter fraud, after the break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Give us a call if you'd like to weigh in. 1-800-892-6477.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with NHPR's Casey McDermott, David Solomon of The Union Leader, and Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org. And with you, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. We're going to be talking about allegations of voter fraud in a moment. We'll also be talking about border checkpoints on I-93 and Marty Bolden. Give us a call now if you'd like to weigh in, 1-800-892-6477. And before we jump into that conversation about allegations of voter fraud, we want to let you know about a conversation scheduled for Monday's program. It's part of our Race for the First series. Host Laura Kanoy is sitting down with the candidates running in New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. And on Monday, we're speaking with Executive Counselor Chris Pappas. What questions do you have for him? Send them now to exchange@nhpr.org. And you can listen back to all the interviews in our Race for the First series at nhpr.org or subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. All right, let's talk about voter fraud. The Ballot Law Commission found that there were no coordinated voter fraud efforts in the state, but instead they found a variety of, quote, idiosyncratic events, people voting in two towns because they thought since they owned property in those two towns, they were entitled to vote. One college student got bad advice from a poll worker and voted in the wrong town. Associate Attorney General Ann Edwards says a number of cases stem from genuine confusion, not any kind of conspiracy to rig elections.
I do believe that there are times where people misunderstand where they should vote, which still fascinates me, but they do. I think that certain people believe that if they own property in two towns, they should be able to vote in different elections in different towns.
Certainly not the case to vote in different towns on the same election. Associate Attorney General Edwards also explained where the origins of the busloads of voters from out of state perception came from.
What happens is at the college campuses, the political parties will rent buses to move the college students around to the polling places so that they can vote. And the buses are usually from out of state. So we've received calls on Vermont buses, Massachusetts buses, and Maine buses. And each time we have sent an investigator out to the polling place, and they have been able to determine that the situation is that the bus company is from Maine or Vermont or Massachusetts, but not the voters on the bus.
So the license plate on the bus does not mean that all those people on the bus are from out of state and part of a vast conspiracy. This is something that we've reported on before, right, Casey?
Extensively.
Yes.
as have my colleagues sitting around this table, because it's been a perennial issue here, and especially so in the last, 2 years since the 2016 election. I do think it's also worth noting that Attorney Edwards also said that, in another case, they got calls because there were a bunch of Massachusetts vehicles parked in a Salem parking lot. Of course, that's right across the border. It was right near a polling place. They sent an investigator out in that place as well. And Attorney Edwards said that they were able to determine that it was just a bunch of Massachusetts residents who thought that there was a more exciting election happening in New Hampshire, and they were holding signs, but they weren't actually going in and trying to vote. So her point being that there are legitimate explanations for why there might be out-of-state vehicles parked in polling places. And I do want to note, I haven't, dug into this super extensively yet, but I did go through some of the kind of past campaign finance filings for the different state parties, and they do show some bus rentals in and around Election Day. So that, kind of lends credence to that theory that that Attorney Edwards was giving for the explanation of the presence of actual buses in New Hampshire, if not illegal voters. But all that being said, I do want to point out that all of the cases that were presented at the Ballot Law Commission today were actually previously explained in a report that we did for NHPR, courtesy of files that were shared with us by the Attorney General's office. We wanted to get a better sense of, okay, what does this issue actually look like? And they shared with us all of their closeout letters, so what they issue at the end of an investigation that they're doing into an allegation of wrongful voting. And as Attorney Edwards and others said this week, and as we previously reported, a lot of those cases ended up either to be an instance of clerical error, so someone who might have crossed off the wrong name when they were checking in a voter in the polls, genuine kind of confusion. There was a case, as you said, where a student tried to go to his true polling place but was sent to another one because he lived right on the boundary of a district and the poll worker was confused. While that technically was illegal of him to not vote in the right polling place, he was acting on bad advice and the state therefore did not prosecute him. There have been about a dozen or so convictions or penalties issued to people where they felt like there was either some kind of malicious intent or, you know, they you know, violated something and it was not as a result of any kind of, you know, bad advice or something like that. But that's out of hundreds of thousands of votes cast in that time period. So on the grand scheme of things, it really is quite minuscule, the amount of fraud, and certainly not, according to state officials who presented this week, the kind of systemic, widespread, massive voter fraud that some politicians and pundits have alluded to.
And Ballot Law Commission Chairman Brad Cook said he hoped this and other information provided to the commission might counter persistent claims of illegal voting in New Hampshire, including those made by President Trump.
And I hope this gives some reinforcement to the people in New Hampshire that our elections are accurate.
So what do you think, Dave Solomon? Are lawmakers going to heed this and say, oh, okay, the data suggests that there's no fraud, let's move forward?
No, it does not move the needle a bit. It has not changed anyone's position on the need for election law reform or the lack of need, depending on your point of view. The data that the Secretary of State and the Attorney General's office shared on Monday was illuminating. It was insightful. It was great to see some of the details on some of these 3 points. You know, what happens to people who give us letters, who we send letters to prove their domicile was what they said it was. What are the actual cases of voter fraud that have been investigated, and what turned up when we cross-checked all of our voter checklists with the voter checklists in other states. They went through all three of those issues and all three of them came to the result, same result. When you really drill and drill and drill, you come up with a very tiny number of cases. So the notion that we have dismissed the idea that there's rampant voter fraud might change anyone's opinion about the underlying issues has proven false, because as we go about and talk to some of the people who supported these changes in election law, they say they're still necessary because even one or two cases is too many, and if these changes help prevent it, that's desirable. And of course, the opponents of bills like 1264 say, see, they're chasing a problem that doesn't exist. So it's good information, but as with so many issues that are polarizing people right now, no new information is changing anybody's opinion.
Gary?
I think it's interesting if you look at the cross-check system that they put in place several years ago. I mean, that turned up about 95,000, it looks like, matches for New Hampshire residents in other states.
It says name in two different lists, but not proof that they voted.
Voted in either. It's just that there's a potential that
first
these
name,
people—
First name, last name, and birthday.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a potential that there's a problem here. But when they dug down— The Secretary of State's office dug down. I mean, they came up with 142 to further investigate. I mean, that's 99% that's not, I mean, it's just, it's not accurate. And I think we need to look it back and see that this whole system was created at the by the Secretary of State of Kansas, Chris Kobach, who was the vice chair of President Trump's Voter Fraud Commission. And I mean, he was pushing this a long time ago, and a few states joined in. And I think a lot of states were very reluctant to do it because of this same reason that we see. It's kind of a scattershot approach to looking at this whole issue.
We've got some comments from listeners, and these comments should probably wrap up our discussion of voting issues. We've got to round up the rest of the week's news today, but I did want to bring these voices in. Someone who did not submit their name wrote in to say, I 100% agree that this is entirely about disenfranchisement. Having out-of-state students be ineligible to vote could make them entirely unable to vote, especially if their home state doesn't allow for voting for someone who doesn't spend the majority of their time living in state. Someone named Travis from Dover commented on Ray Chadwick, chairman of Granite State Taxpayers. We had him on just a little while ago. Ray Chadwick stated, a driver's license proves residency. Travis writes, this isn't true. When I moved back to New Hampshire last year, I had to prove I was a resident with supporting documentation, including utility bills with my address on them before I was issued a driver's license. Mary in Plymouth wrote in to recommend, I don't know anyone who runs to obtain a new driver's license as soon as they move to the state. They wait until it expires. There is an expense involved. And if you do not have to put your street address on your license, I would guess that at least half college students do not move back to the place they grew up. College students change address every year. That's from Mary in Plymouth. Thank you very much for weighing in on that. We're going to move on from this voting stuff now. We've got some other things to talk about. But if you have a question or comment about the week's news, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to talk about the border checkpoints on I-93 in just a little bit. But first, I want to turn to Casey McDermott on a story that she's been covering for NHPR for a while now. That's the story of Marty Bolden, the Sununu administration's top drug policy advisor. He was put on paid administrative leave for a while because of allegations of bullying staff members. Now, Casey, as you report this week, he's resigned. So explain this latest twist for us.
Yeah, so I should be clear that they've not actually given a specific reason that he was put on paid leave.
So we
started reporting this a little over a month ago. We had heard that Mr. Bolden, who was a top drug policy advisor, he was hired actually for a newly created position at the beginning of Governor Sununu's term. And his position was really wide-reaching. He would deal with everything from kind of drug policy to working with members of the governor's commission, working with providers in the prevention and recovery fields, doing various kind of initiatives and outreach on behalf of the governor. So basically, we had heard that he was put on paid leave. And I had also heard from sources who were, had direct knowledge of the situation that some of the questions that were being raised had to do with allegations that he engaged in bullying or other kind of intimidating behavior in his role as the governor's advisor. So that was at the end of April that he was put on paid leave. We weren't quite sure what exactly caused that, but what we did know this week is that he resigned after about a month and after the Attorney General completed its review. And what we also learned this week is that he was placed on leave a day after the governor's office was made aware of an email that had been sent in March among staffers with the Department of Health and Human Services, in which one employee raised concerns about Bolden's interactions with prevention providers. And specifically in that email, the person said that Bolden had allegedly become angry with someone who was not returning multiple calls that he made on nights and weekends to this person, that as a result of that interaction, that particular person felt it necessary to establish a safety plan involving interactions with Bolden, and that other organizations were also developing their own safety plans, either based on their current experiences with Marty or concerns about future experiences with him. And that's directly from a copy of the email that we have independently obtained and verified at NHPR. So what we did not know until this week, until the governor's office confirmed it, was that he was placed on leave the following day after their office was made aware of that email. So we still don't have a clear, this is the specific reason, but we know that that perhaps was part of it. And otherwise, the Attorney General's office and the governor's office are staying fairly tight-lipped on this. They're saying it's a personnel issue and therefore needs to remain confidential.
Is that true? They really can't comment on
this? That's a frequent excuse from public agencies, and it is an excuse that is in part codified in the state's right to know law. There's a personnel exemption for certain records that an agency deems would be, an invasion of privacy or something like that. I think it is worth pointing out that Mr. Bolden and any other public official for that matter is a public official, and their conduct in their office is, one could make the argument, the public's business. But that being said, I also think it's important to note that the governor's office said that has also acknowledged that they have received had received two other kind of concerns prior to when they put him on paid leave, one of which had to do with a report that students on the governor's youth council may have been being asked to work on council activities during school hours. Separately, the governor actually told reporters that he was also made aware that Marty was having people volunteer to help with the recovery-friendly workplaces and that there were some issues in terms of the demands that he was placing on those people. But they said that both of those were, you know, unsubstantiated and they had dealt with them, you know, proactively, basically. So there's a lot of questions here, I think, about who knew what when and what exactly happened. But I think that it's, you know, we're gonna continue looking into it and seeing what we can find out.
Dave Solomon.
It's really unfortunate that as the state tries to grapple with this overwhelming opioid crisis, that we continue to have these difficulties in administration and policy advising at the highest levels. Maggie Hassan had her drug czar had to resign amid complaints that he was uninvolved, that he just hid in his office, that he could never be engaged with the was not engaging with the recovery community to a sufficient degree. And now we have this unfortunate situation where this incumbent apparently was overly aggressive in his engagement to ways much to the detriment of the effort and in the obviously not well regarded in the recovery community. So obviously someone needs to find the sweet spot between isolation and overly aggressive interaction with the agencies you're supposed to be helping, not directing.
Well, is there any sense now, Dave Casey, that the governor's office is going to fill this position again right away? No,
they didn't say what they plan to do with it moving forward. I think it's also worth pointing out that Mr. Bolden's salary was coming from the same pool of money that's controlled by the Governor's Commission for Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery. So that's the same pot that's used on a number of other addiction support services across the state. So it may be a situation where they look at, okay, do we want to continue to use that money to pay someone to pay someone's salary, or do we want to put that back into programs or services to directly go to people in need?
I think it's a case of, you know, this is something that's the state is new to, and it's been trying to ramp up its programs for quite some of the last 4 or 5 years, and it's just been a real slog. It's been tough. I mean, they haven't really. It's been a kind of fits and starts. And this is just another example. You know, you try this and it doesn't work. We got to try this. We got to try that. And it's going to be a while before all this becomes much more smooth and it works a little easier and the providers are in place, because we didn't have providers in place when this all started. I mean, it's a whole new ball game, and there are going to be problems.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. We're speaking with Gary Reyna of InDepthNH.org, NHPR's Casey McDermott, and Dave Solomon of the Union Leader. And with you, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email us about the week's news, exchange@nhpr.org. Still to come, former Attorney General under the Obama administration, Eric Holder, is here in New Hampshire speaking about gerrymandering, and his visit has people asking about his 2020 presidential aspirations. What do you think of Holder as a possible candidate for president? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where we are broadcasting a live video of today's radio show. Check it out, Facebook NHPR Exchange. We'll learn more about the week's news in just a few. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with NHPR's Casey McDermott, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, and Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org. Give us a call to join the conversation about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. We've got a few more things to talk about this hour. We're going to talk about Eric Holder's visit to New Hampshire. We'll talk about the checkpoints on I-93. I want to bring in listener comments whenever possible. We get this one from John in Nottingham, who says, wondering if the governor is or has signed the three renewable energy bills on his desk. These were in direct opposition to the latest 10-year energy plan, according to John in Nottingham. Panelists, what do you think?
Dave? He hasn't made a decision yet. Kevin Landrigan addresses this in some detail in Granite Status column yesterday, pointing out that this is a set of energy-related bills that really has Governor Sununu between a rock and a hard place. They are designed to promote renewable energy. Two of them involve requiring the utilities to pay above market costs for energy generated by wood burning plants. There's six wood burning power plants in the state, and the largest being the Burgess one in Berlin. And these plants provide a lot of employment for the people that work in them and for the forest industry that provides the raw material.
And just for a little bit of context, John mentioned that this would go against Sununu's 10-year energy plan, which I think was supposed to ostensibly not pick, quote, winners and losers. And you're saying this one would pay above market prices?
Right. The bills call for the utilities to pay above market prices for electricity, in effect, to subsidize wood-burning power in the state. The defenders of that idea say it's a good proposition because it only raises electric bills by pennies, but produces millions of dollars of economic development and economic growth in the North Country and the places where these mills exist. The problem for the governor is he just put out an energy policy, the fundamental premise of which these subsidies should only be used if they lower rates, that the primary goal of the objective of the energy policy should be to lower rates. Subsidizing renewable fuel plants at higher rates does not have that effect. So he's got some tough decisions to make.
Gary?
And the third bill would expand the net metering program to larger users, which again would drive up the cost a little bit of electricity. So he's got a really tough decision here in all three of these bills.
Okay. Let's talk about those checkpoints on I-93. These happened earlier this year. Basically, Border Patrol finding some drugs on people, finding people who were in the country illegally. Same thing happened this time around on Memorial Day. 17 people from a variety of countries taken into custody. And also some drugs and drug paraphernalia were found. And now, once again, the ACLU is a little concerned about this. Dave, why is the ACLU concerned about this?
Well, I think they have a concern about it from the perspective of the even from the perspective of the illegal immigration charges, which are well within the legal purview of the Border Patrol. They have a right to stop anybody without probable cause within 100 miles of a border and ask them to produce documentation that and prove that they are legally in the country. And in this case, I think they found about 17 instances where they had potential prosecutions of immigration law. The ACLU is raising concerns about their being justifiable probable cause for those stops and searches even in those cases. But I think the larger concern is that American citizens who happen to be traveling the roadways within 100 miles of an American border could be subjected to random search and seizure as we see more of this, what's been called immigration enforcement on steroids. And some contraband seized by legal residents of the country stopped in these raids is what's being of greatest concern.
Mm-hmm. And Casey, you actually passed through one of these checkpoints.
Actually, I was up in the North Country rounding out my Memorial Day weekend up there. And on the way back, when we were traveling through, I think, the Woodstock area, we ran into this. And I will say that it was, you know, there was a little bit of a backup. They were not pulling over every car. It was hard to discern, you know, the pattern by which they were deciding who to wave over and who not to. But I do think it's interesting that, like, it was not, you know, it was not your kind of typical like holiday weekend traffic jam. At first, I thought it was just like, okay, a little bit of congestion coming back from up north. And I do think it's also interesting, just given the kind of context of the last month or so. Obviously, there was that court, the ruling from a judge that they were not that basically the searches were unconstitutional, and that the evidence collected in those searches, if I'm understanding correctly, could not be used as part of charges that were brought against people in state courts. Now, my question is kind of, you know, does it matter that, at least according to initial reports, local and state police were not involved this time around? And is that in any way, you know, an effort to, you know, circumvent that recent ruling with regard to the state courts? So I think it'll be, you know, worth kind of watching how both sides make those arguments.
Mm-hmm. And worth mentioning, too, that the Border Patrol is planning on doing 5 more of these.
I believe so, according to, I think, the Concord Monitor.
Okay. More to discuss this week, including a gentleman by the name of Bob Burns. He has launched his Republican bid for Congress in the 2nd District, highlighting his relationship with President Donald Trump. Gary, you're familiar with Bob Burns. Who is he?
Well, Bob Burns has been around for quite a while. He's run for a lot of offices. He and Chris Pappas went back and forth for a few elections. One of them was for, I believe, treasurer for Hillsborough County, and then for the executive council seat. This is another case of somebody who actually doesn't live in a district is running in for the 2nd District. He lives in Bedford, which is actually in the 1st District. Hmm. And then in reverse of that, we have Bernie Sanders' son running from the 2nd District. He's actually running in the 1st District. What's interesting about Bob is when he announced his candidacy, he tied himself very closely to President Trump. He was on he was one of his, I believe, on some committee, campaign committee that he was on Trump's, and particularly he's trying to, put himself up a little bit of apart from the other candidates that are in that race. There are 4 others. There's Representative Steve Negron, Dr. Stuart Levinson, Lynn Blackenbecker, and one other, Brian Belanger. And most of them, I think you could say, were very conservative Republicans. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to grab the Trump banner here and run with it.
And he says he's got the most name recognition now.
He does. Well, he's been on the ballot a few times. He's also lost quite a few times. So it'll be interesting to see. None of these people have raised a lot of money. And Annie Custer certainly has raised a lot of money. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Still time for you to call and get a question about the week's news in. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. So former Attorney General Eric Holder is speaking this morning at St. Anselm College as part of the Politics and Eggs series. And he says he is waiting until next year to decide whether or not to run for president. I spoke to him yesterday. He wouldn't commit one way or the other, wouldn't even say if he's leaning one way or the other. But he's speaking a lot these days about gerrymandering, which he says he's not quite sure to what extent voters will care about this. But he did make his case for caring about it.
Gerrymandering results in legislatures that are not following the wishes of the people on issues that affect the American people on a day-to-day basis, whether it is, you know, expanding background checks, voter suppression laws, expanding Medicaid, whether it has to do with reproductive rights. There's a whole range of issues that are affected by gerrymandering, where Republicans are taking positions inconsistent with the desires of their constituents.
And gerrymandering certainly been in the news a lot recently in cases across the country about districts that have been
Pennsylvania
drawn.
Pennsylvania was a big case.
Pennsylvania, Dave?
Everyone will be watching. The court redrew the districts there, and everyone will be watching in the election to see what result that may have in flipping some congressional seats. But, you know, if Holder's making a campaign around the issue of gerrymandering, just as other high-profile figures are focused on campaign finance reform or gun control, that's great. All these issues need individual voices. If it's if it's testing the waters for a presidential bid and he's searching for that issue that's going to ignite the Democratic base, like immigration, just set everything on fire for Donald Trump's benefit. I don't know if gerrymandering is going to work, but it certainly is an important issue.
Casey?
I do want to point out that I was part of a panel that was talking about kind of the state of the various kind of political campaigns leading up to the midterms a few weeks ago, and was speaking to a group of people who I think it was open to anyone, but I think most of the people in the audience were probably leaning left and more progressive. And there was a lot of enthusiasm in that room and a lot of energy around the issue of redistricting. And while it was kind of a subset of the larger electorate and, you know, a much more engaged group, I think would be a fair assessment than your average voter. I think that it was striking to me just how engaged they were on this issue that can often make people's eyes glaze over when you talk about, you know, district lines and demographics and, you know, kind of packing and cracking districts, as people call it. So I think that's of note. And I think that there are kind of generally more people paying attention to the kind of nuts and bolts issues around how democracy functions these days than before. I think a lot of people are more interested in things like the Electoral College, campaign finance reform, voting systems. So I think this is kind of part and parcel of that. I also think it's important to point out that former Attorney General Eric Holder is actually the head of an organization that's called the National Democratic Redistricting Committee that, among other things, has a lot of money pouring into PACs that will be, you know, conceivably used to educate people or sway opinion around this issue. So there's a lot of money that's being poured into this, really in the same way that we're seeing a lot of money pouring into more PACs around voting rights and things like that. So,
Gary?
Well, just to bring it home a little bit, talk about redistricting. The last time we redistricted, we had a very Republican legislature. And the Senate was redrawn, we alluded to this before, in such a way that it packed Democrats in various various districts to the point where they really could never take control of the Senate. Yet in the next two elections that we had, Democratic votes for Democratic state senators outnumbered votes for Republican state senators. So if you just took the overall vote, Democrats would have controlled the Senate as opposed to the Republicans. And it was 13-11 at best. The House, similarly, it's a little harder to redistrict the House because there's so many seats. But still, it was very much a plan that was favorable to Republicans who were sitting in power. And particularly the Executive Council is another example. District 2 in the Executive Council includes Keene, Concord, and Durham. So, I mean, if you're a Republican trying to run in the second district of the Executive Council, you're never going to have a chance. Mm-hmm. You know?
Casey?
This is also coming up at the state level in the kind of ongoing campaign for the Secretary of State's office. We've seen Colin Van Ostern, in particular, one of the challengers to Secretary of State Bill Gardner, really make this a central focus. He's even gone so far as to come up with a kind of mascot for what he sees as the worst of gerrymandering, and he's dubbed it Gerrymander, which is what he calls the Dragon District that I think Gary was alluded to that he used to represent, which stretches from Keene to Durham. So I think that's another example of how Democrats are trying to get people to, you know, at the very least, listen to them when they talk about gerrymandering. But I think it'll be, you know, it remains to be seen how this will actually break through to the broader public.
With respect to Eric Holder's possible candidacy for president in 2020, Steve on Plum Island wrote in to say, Holder wrote the DOJ policy during the Clinton presidency that limited DOJ's willingness to go after the banks. Say no to Holder. That's from Steve on Plum Island. I don't personally know a whole lot about what Eric Holder did during the Clinton administration, but speaking to Holder yesterday about his role in the Obama administration, essentially he had said at one point, you know, the banks are perhaps too large to prosecute criminally for involvement leading up to the financial crash in 2008. But he insisted that lawmakers should do something to make sure that this is possible and in the meantime work with regulators and didn't make it to the final cut of the interview you heard on All Things Considered yesterday, but he did speak about how regulators have built a better relationship with the banks. So thank you very much for that comment, Steve. I appreciate it. One more thing that we need to talk about here before the end of the show. We get a call from Jack. Rest assured, Jack, we will talk about this. Jack wrote in, hope you don't forget to talk about chickens. I think chickens can do a lot of damage to it. This is an actual email. I think chickens can do a lot of damage to a garden. Jack, you are right. You are right. Let's talk about chickens. Basically, there's a new law signed by the governor. Everybody's laughing here. A new law signed by the governor this week says that if your free-range chickens wander onto someone else's property, you might be fined. This is the trespassing stock law. So anybody at this table have to rush home and sort of mend your chicken fences?
No.
I don't think my apartment has room for a pen.
No chicken pen in Casey's apartment. Okay, but this is something that came up every now and then. It's kind of like a ha-ha, it happens. But I guess there's more people in urban environments.
I do want to point out that I just in the last minute or so pulled up chickens New Hampshire on Google and got a return on the Portsmouth police log for earlier in May for a chicken investigation that their officers were sent out to. So it's unclear what exactly that was for, but it appears to be at least on the radar of some local law enforcement.
Why there's a rising appeal. A larger number of people living in suburban settings apparently have an interest in maintaining some type of agrarian farming type of existence. I have friends who I've worked with that live in Concord that have chickens, and they can be quite a distraction if they get loose, chasing them down, keeping them corralled, dealing with the neighbors. But apparently the fresh eggs and the fun the kids have in seeing the whole process of raising barnyard animals in a subdivision of Concord has some appeal.
Yeah, and they eat ticks, right? Can't they neutralize the threat of Lyme disease in your yard? Yeah?
Yes.
So they can destroy a garden, but they can save you from Lyme disease, perhaps. So, you know, you win some, you lose some.
I think we need to say it's free range or die.
Free range or die. Okay. That's the hashtag now. Well, thank you very much. I want to thank everybody for being here today. NHPR's Casey McDermott, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org. Thank you for being here and lending your insight on the week's news.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And remember, the conversation continues online on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We also put a link to all the stories we discussed during this program at NHPR.org. So if you want to read more about them, check that out. This is a production. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Rebecca Lavoy is on the cameras here. You can watch a rebroadcast of this show. Hello, everybody on the internet. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.